welcome to the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z right here on Progressive Radio Network. We're so happy to bring you the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, especially because you can listen live every Tuesday from 10 to 11 a.m., and you can catch the show on the archive. And when we look at our archive, the Podbean archive and also the PRN archive, we see that we have over 100,000 people who have, in fact, downloaded and played the archive. So thank you guys so much for participating. You can always join us at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse, for more information. And we have lots of classes in person as well as online. And today we are happy to have as our guest Anne Fanfa. Anne is going to tell us her personal story about her breast cancer adventure, let's say, and also the fact that she had a very positive outcome and then moved into being someone who is a major promoter and information source for those who would like to know more about what's available in terms of complementary and alternative cancer treatments. She discovered what has worked and also has yearly conferences as well as a fantastic website which allows people to find out more on their own. And that is the AnnieAppleseedProject.org. So now that I said the Annie Appleseed Project, I bet many of you are recognizing our guest today. And welcome to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Hi, Anne. How are you?
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
Wow, you sound perfect, loud and clear. That's excellent. And why don't you go back in time and talk about your past and maybe what led you to your present future.
Okay, I love that you used adventure. That's a riot. Looking back now, it's almost 22 years. January will be 22 years since my diagnosis. So looking back, it's an adventure. At the time, I was stumble, bumble, fumbling along. So I was 44 when I got a cancer diagnosis, and I found a lump. Actually, I found what seemed like a callus on my left breast at what they call 2 o'clock, figuring that 12 o'clock is straight up. And I didn't know anybody alive with cancer. The only person I knew who had cancer was my grandfather, who had died, and he died.
So you don't have a really intense, let's say, history, family history of that.
Well, you know, that's interesting, too, because even though it gets a lot of publicity, really only 7 to 10% is a hereditary cancer. And no, I didn't have that at all. In fact, I have many women cousins and a sister, and we have no breast cancer in the subsequent 20 years since my diagnosis, which is great. So there I was, knowing nothing. But a lot of, you know, what they say, there's no coincidences. So one of the things that impacted my life was, well, there were several things. One was that I was suffering from multiple chemical sensitivity. And if people don't know what that is,
We have time because, you know, that is becoming a really big issue for many people. And they feel extremely disenfranchised because that's not recognized.
Even now. So I started to feel that way, I knew, about 1989, and I was diagnosed with cancer in 93. So the first thing that happened was I recognized that I had candida, you know, vaginally, and very uncomfortable. I went to the gynecologist. I got, at that time, a prescription for Monistat.
Let me ask you this. Did you take antibiotics before that?
Not particularly.
That
in fact, I was lucky. When I was a kid, my doctor, I guess a pediatrician, was really not in favor of using antibiotics. So even though I had a lot of throat infections, I really didn't get a lot of antibiotics from him. So it was really hard to explain. There I was with this systemic candida. I go to the gynecologist. She gives me Monistat, and she's giving me Monistat every month.
Okay,
I have another
question for you, Anne. You talked about the fact that it was manifesting vaginally. That's well known. But when you talk about systemic, did the doctor actually agree that you had systemic candida? Because to this day, doctors are saying that that's a fantasy, which is amazing.
Right. I didn't get any help at all, but I was having rashes all over my body. I was becoming weak and sometimes actually fell down if I smelled which is what I identified later, almost a year later. If I smelled fragrance or wet paint or cleaning products or carpeting that was new or furniture that was fake wood, you know, formaldehyde and all that kind of thing. So after a year of the vaginal cream, I said to the doctor, you know, this is a year and this is not good. And she said, oh, you're probably diabetic. So because I was already a vegetarian, although I wasn't majorly, well, by then I was eating pretty healthy, but I also didn't, I don't have a sweet tooth, so I wasn't having a lot of sweet stuff. And I thought being a diabetic was really bizarre from her point of view. She did no testing, you know. She just announces, oh, I'm probably a diabetic. So that was weird. And finally, because I'm not sure how I found somebody, but I bumped into someone who could help me. I believe I found an applied kinesiologist when I was looking for a chiropractor. And somehow I began to speak to someone who said, you know, this could be more than candida. It could be, I mean, more than vaginal problems. It could be systemic. And I began to think about that. But, you know, it didn't really have substance. However, I also began to recognize what the triggers were. So when I smell something, it would put me, I would become so weak and so dizzy and headachy that sometimes I was in bed for 2 or 3 days at a time. And so I fast forward to the time I'm diagnosed with breast cancer. It didn't seem like anything because I wasn't in pain. I couldn't, first of all, I thought, you know, I thought you can't get breast cancer unless your mother had it. So I was shocked to the max, very surprised. And it just didn't seem real. And it all happened very, very quickly. I went in on a Thursday. The doctor, the nurse came in. She said, oh, we have a schedule for you on Monday, and the insurance company approved it. So I actually thought at that time that if your insurance company required a second opinion, it was like a burden, instead of understanding that it was a great opportunity to make sure that the diagnosis. So I was very happy. I didn't have to do anything else. But I also heard from that, oh, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, oh, my God, my cancer is terrible. I'm going to die. Plus, my grandfather had died. So I thought I was really in serious condition, even though I didn't feel sick at all from that. And I had a lumpectomy that Monday. However, so Friday I go to work. Yeah, Saturday I, you know, my husband and I lay in bed hugging each other, and I'm assuring him everything will be fine, while in my own head I'm playing back, oh, this is my last Saturday on earth. It was cute. Sunday, the whole day goes by. Sunday night I got a phone call. You know, again, I didn't know anybody with cancer. I was 44. So it's, and people weren't really talking about it in January of 1993. It was like just the brink of cancer discussion. So on Sunday night, this woman calls me and she says, you don't know me, but I am a 10-year breast cancer survivor. And in that moment, I knew that I could survive. I knew. And she's basically saved my life, because I think that if I had gone in with the mindset that this was my last minute on earth, I might have died. I believe that we are, you know, guided a lot by that mental state. Anyway, in addition to that, when I was awakening from surgery and not really awake, a woman's voice said to me, you had a lumpectomy and now you're fine. So I thought, I must be fine. And the doctor, when he was, the surgeon, when he was telling me about the treatment, saying you're going to have a lumpectomy, and I hadn't had a biopsy. We just went right to a lumpectomy, and he said lumpectomy radiation. So I had spent a lot of time being an anti-nuclear activist most of my youth and through those years. So I said to myself, I wonder if they sue me if I don't take radiation, because I don't think I want to do that. So everything was a bit, it was weird. And so I came out of surgery. I had this lumpectomy. I went home. I had brought my own food because I ate organic by then. Made my mother bring me juices from the health food store. And my husband said to the doc, could she go home right away? So on the second morning, I left, which was great, because being allergic to everything, believe me, a hospital is the worst place to be. I mean, there's smells, there's chemicals, there's everything was going on. So I went home. But I didn't sleep the first night, nor did I sleep the entire week after the surgery. I don't know if that was anesthesia acting weird on my chemically sensitive body, which didn't react normally, or it was just the, you know, the fear or whatever. But I mean, I was calmer by then, and I really didn't, you know, I no longer thought I was going to die, so things got easier. And when I went home, like I said, I didn't sleep for a week, so the first night that I'm home, I was being so careful not to bump into my left side, the left side of my body, which was, of course, bandaged, that I broke the pinky toe on my right foot. So that was a great welcome home little moment, and proving that, you know, just because you have cancer doesn't mean you can't do other stupid things. But one of my close friends had become an acupuncturist 2 years before my actual cancer diagnosis. And, you know, I didn't know anything about it, but it seemed like a really interesting something, and I wanted to be a good friend, so I began to see her. So in 91, I was actually having acupuncture. And one of the things that happened for me was that she stopped my having menstrual cramps. So they never came back, and I was amazed. It was 3 months of this, you know, I thought just doing her a favor, and meanwhile she really changed my life for the better. So I had a good feeling about acupuncture. But because it was my close friend, I didn't really recognize that it was alternative medicine. It was, you know, it was Francis. And so now I'm done with surgery, and I meet with an oncologist. And the oncologist says to me, we'll start chemo next week. And I said,
oh, that's
well,
interesting, because you said after the surgery they said that everything was okay. So why
right, but you know, then you discover it unrolls day by day. So the next thing is the doctor says we'll do chemo. Now, this was before, you know, one of the things that astounded me about cancer diagnosis, we give chemo, we don't know if it'll benefit you, and it will certainly harm you, but hey, we'll give you chemo. So they didn't know if I needed it. It was just standard to give it to everybody.
Standard
and I said
of practice.
To the doctor, yeah, I said to the doctor, look, you know, I have a problem. And he said, it doesn't matter. And I said, could I tell you what the problem is before you dismiss it? So I tell him about my chemical sensitivity, and I've spent the last 4 or 5 years being ill all the time. I spend time in bed. Things are not going right. And he says again, oh, it doesn't matter. Well, of course it mattered, and I just couldn't, you know, I couldn't deal with that, so I left, because how could I talk to someone who thinks the most important thing in my life doesn't matter? So I went home, and I was angry, and I'm an overnight kind of thinker, so overnight I fume, and I fume, and in the morning I say, well, that's the end of that. I'm not going to do chemo. They don't even get who I am, and I don't want to be the cancer in room 7. I want to be the person who needs Ann Fonfa's treatment. So now what do I do, you know? And I redouble my efforts. I'm only eating organic. I'm exercising. I find something called metabolic enzyme therapy, and I get blood work done. I send it to them, and I get the report. And in conversation with the doctor on the report, it says on the report that I need to drink a lot of water. And I'm drinking about 60 ounces of water a day, so I'm thinking, well, what's going on here? You know, this isn't good. And what I find in general, and this is, you know, sad, in general, if you don't fit into the system, whether it's mainstream or alternative, you don't. There's not a lot of wiggle room. Everybody's kind of set in what they offer, and you have to fit what they offer. And I wanted the opposite. I wanted treatment for who I was and what was going on for me. So it was a very tricky time. And I began to, I was seeing my friend Frances, the acupuncturist, and she was treating me, and she said, you know, if you do chemo, I have some herbs that can help you. That was interesting news. I didn't know that. And she said, if you do or when you do radiation, I have herbs for that. So my husband said to me, don't make a political decision about radiation. You've got to go visit a radiation oncologist and have a conversation. And I really didn't want to do that, but I did. And, you know, unsurprisingly, the radiation oncologist suggested I have radiation. Now, I had a lumpectomy, and the standard protocol, apparently, was radiation, lumpectomy with radiation.
But don't they usually measure the edges and see if it's invasive and if there's any involvement in other lymph nodes that are nearby before they recommend radiation?
So that reminds me that this doctor, the first surgeon, removed 18 lymph nodes, didn't tell me that he was going to do that kind of surgery, and I knew nothing at all. I didn't even know I could choose my own surgeon. So he removed 18 lymph nodes without my express or informed consent. Of course, I signed the document, which they give you when you're about to enter the operating room and your mind is in another place, let's just put it that way. And but I didn't know they were going to do that surgery. So he took 18 lymph nodes. They're all negative, but my left arm is, you know, develops lymphedema almost immediately, my chest, my back.
Wait a minute, you said a very important thing. So they tested the lymph nodes that they removed.
Correct. All of them were
negative
for cancer.
Okay, so I know several patients, of course, actually hundreds in my 35 years of practice, with people who, when they test the lymph nodes and they do not see any kind of spreading, they don't necessarily recommend radiation.
Right.
Maybe this is because it's longer ago in time that they still were, or
yeah,
just the place does?
Right now, radiation is the norm with a lumpectomy. It doesn't matter about your lymph nodes. It's an automatic thing. But
And what about the use of chemo, additional chemo?
Well, that there's a test now, several tests, that help determine whether a person with node negative, which is what I had, breast cancer, needs chemotherapy. And there are some other cancers that can be tested for chemo as well, which is a great development because it was insane to give it to everybody, whether they needed it or not. I mean, I made a list right away of 12 things that I thought were insane, and that was number one. How can you give a harmful drug like chemotherapy to everybody? So, but back then, it wasn't even an issue. It was offered to me. I refused it. Then the radiation thing happens. Everything that can go wrong goes wrong in the first meeting. I arrive at the hospital at Beth Israel South downtown, and it's in the basement, and I mean, it's creepy, really. And I get weighed for the first thing, and I weigh 18 pounds less than I thought. And I had a heart attack right at the moment. I said, oh, my God, I'm dying, because the only thing, you know, one of the few things I knew about cancer was that you lose weight and you die. And I thought, I can't believe this. I'm going to die. So, you know, it was just pathetic. And then the nurse says, oh, no, our scale is underweight.
Wow.
I said, you're joking, right? How could you let that happen? Why don't you adjust this scale? I mean, so they didn't adjust the scale, and then I have a moment of panic, but I get over that. And then I'm being, they put your arm over your head in a plaster cast, and they make a cast so that your arm will be above your head while you're taking radiation. And your hand's supposed to be flat on your head. So I have lymphedema of the hand. My hand is swollen and painful, and it slips behind my head while this cast is hardening. And I say to the tech, oh, my hand just slipped. I have to move it. And he says, oh, no, you can't move it because the plaster has to harden. I said, I know, but my hand's in the wrong place. So we had one of these ridiculous conversations, and he says, okay, I'll ask the doctor. But he does not. And I'm lying down, my arm's in this cast, and I, you know, everything's wrong. My hand hurts. It was bad. The next thing that happens is the tech who's measuring me for how they would do the radiation field, and she's also doing tattooing, she says, oh, I wish the doctor would stay in the room. I'm just a student. I'm really not sure what I'm doing. I'm thinking, oh, this is perfect. You're going to radiate me, and you don't know what you're doing. And then the fourth thing that happens, the doctor in conversation tells me they have a new machine and an old machine. And I said, oh, well, I would really want the new machine. And she says, well, it's whichever machine is available when you arrive. So those four things, I go home and I say to my husband, forget it. I'm not doing this. This is crazy. Plus, evidence-based has been of great interest to me all along, and there's a study from something called the National Surgical Adjuvant Breast and Bowel Project, which is a kind of quasi-governmental group out of University of either Pittsburgh or Pennsylvania, I think UPenn, and they had done a study called B06, and the protocol was trying to decide whether mastectomy and lumpectomy were equivalent. And it was already known in Europe, so that's another thing I fault our system for. It's very, very, very slow. And new ideas take forever. So they're doing a study of something that really everybody kind of already knew. So they do a study with three arms. The first arm is mastectomy, just like they always did. Big, heavy-duty, take-everything-you-can mastectomy. The second one is lumpectomy with radiation. And the third arm is lumpectomy with no radiation. 8 years out, the survival's basically the same in all three arms. So I said, well, if it isn't about survival, I'm not going to do it. So I didn't do radiation. So here I didn't do chemo,
now,
I didn't do radiation.
Did your doctors, you know, give you a lot of flack and say they won't treat
you
anymore if you don't do it?
They called my husband at his office, and they said, your wife's going to die. She doesn't want to do radiation. First of all, you don't die from
even
lack of radiation.
Even though there was no evidence to support that statement.
That's correct. I mean, there's no evidence to this day. So it was a completely off-track thing, because what we know about radiation, it reduces the risk of recurrence. It's local disease. And people with cancer do not die from local disease. They die from metastatic spread to the organs. So that was just completely off-track. But, you know, we didn't know much, but we knew that was wrong. And then it was harassment. And people to this day have told me that they get calls from the doctor harassing them or their family members about their choices. And that's completely crazy. So it was crazy. But, you know, so here
well,
I am. I'm doing,
you know, part of that, of course, just in the defense of the doctors, is when there is a standard of practice in place and you don't employ that standard of practice, and let's say the patient does die, then if you did not push for that standard of practice, the doctor themselves are liable. And the patient's relatives can actually sue them, and do.
Yes, and actually,
so
I know that
it's not such a clear-cut case.
I know they have to offer the standard. And you know, the thing is, there's no, I mean, this is not personalized medicine, and they're talking about it as though it exists, but it doesn't exist even now. And at the time, I just felt none of it applied to me, and I didn't want to go through with it. And I felt, given the study I had seen, that I didn't need to do radiation.
That was, but, you know, I think, such an excellent choice. You know, Ann, we're just going to take a little break right here. And when we continue, we're going to continue our discussion with all the interesting things that you have found that do have some very good data in terms of helping, as you said, individuals. And that's what's so great about your website, AnnieAppleseedProject.org. If any of our listeners want to look that up while we continue our discussion, they will know how to find that information in the future. And we'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the nutrient known as taurine.
Amino acids are chemical constituents that form the building blocks of protein in the body. The official definition of an amino acid is a compound which contains an amino group and a carboxylic acid. Taurine contains a sulfonic group instead, so is not a true amino acid, although it is often referred to as one. The intracellular concentration of taurine is 10 times that of any normal free amino acid.
Taurine was discovered in 1827, but the significance of taurine in nutrition was not realized until 1975, when the journal Science published a study showing that taurine-deficient cats suffered from retinal degeneration. In 1986, the Annual Review of Biochemistry reported that the amount of taurine present in mammalian milk depends on the species. Natural human mother's milk is rich in taurine, but cow's milk, except for the early milk known as colostrum, is taurine deficient. Pediatrics Journal in 1983 printed a study which outlined several of the biologically significant functions of taurine, and an effort was then made to fortify infant formula by adding taurine.
Some species of animals, such as cats, cannot synthesize taurine within their bodies, and so must receive it through their diets. Humans have a very limited ability to synthesize taurine, so adequate intake through diet and supplementation is important. The principal source of dietary taurine is meat of various types and shellfish. Even people ingesting sufficiently high levels of taurine may develop a deficiency due to the overgrowth of certain anaerobic intestinal microorganisms which consume taurine. Certain prescription drugs are known inhibitors of taurine uptake.
The Journal of Neurochemistry published a study in 1975 which showed that taurine concentrations are extremely high in the retina. In fact, the retina contains two binding proteins specific for taurine. Research has yet to determine exactly how taurine functions in the eye, but deficiency of taurine has been found to lead to the degeneration of photoreceptor cells. Continued studies on taurine have linked its presence to several biological functions, besides being a protector of the delicate tissues of the eye. Taurine helps to neutralize oxidizing agents caused by ionizing radiation. Taurine is present in high concentrations in the normal heart. It stimulates white blood cell motility and protects cell membranes from free radical damage. Taurine has proven useful in epileptics to reduce or control seizures. It helps modulate the transport of substances such as sodium, potassium, magnesium, copper, and iron across cell membranes. Additional research supports taurine's role in preventing gallstones.
So, as you can see, the nutrient taurine may be an important addition to your Natural Medicine Chest.
Right here to Gary Knowles Network, Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, where you can listen to all the shows that are here, both when we have the shows, like The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z at 10 to 11 a.m. every Tuesday, that's New York time, or on the archives, and that's 24/7. You can listen to any of the shows and find out information about natural medicine, how to use herbs, how to use supplements, how to take your health and the health of your cells and your family seriously and make your own decisions. And with that in mind, we have as our guest today Anne Feinfa, and she produces a fantastic website that gathers together all kinds of information by different cancer types and alternative and natural therapies, where you can find out the information that she is talking about here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. So welcome back again, Anne.
Thank you.
And you shared with us your story, which was kind of a struggle, and about how you wound up making a decision, although you did get lumpectomies, to not proceed with chemotherapy.
Right, and I also chose not to do radiation, and I remain happy about that. I came from a family of heart disease, so yeah, my whole heart, my left lung were in the frame for radiation. In those days, you know, they say now it's more targeted, but I'm not 100% clear on that. In any case, I didn't do it. So what do I do? The whole time, I was doing acupuncture in the background to keep my immune system strong. I was I had a good belief that I needed to stay strong in order to be healthy. And so it was important to me to eat organic, and I was also getting applied kinesiology, which is a kind of chiropractic. And I tried a lot of different things. I mean, I had magnets, and I put magnets in my bra, and I wore them every single night and to bed, and all this kind of stuff that may or may not have helped. The situation was, you know, there was no clear-cut path. And even to this day, I can't say, do this one thing and you'll be cured. I really don't feel that's possible. I think there's something that might work for everybody, but nobody really knows what it is. You kind of have to delve in and see how you feel and take steps. There are certain things, though, that I think everyone should do, and this is really a function of all the years that I've been doing this kind of work, and that is, you know, eat real fruits and vegetables, as many as possible every day. Get off of sugar. Never drink soda. No deep-fried foods. I mean, probably your listeners know this stuff, but it is so critical not to fall into the trap of thinking it's okay to have garbage for food. It's just not okay. It's really poisonous for our human bodies. So turmeric, probiotics, fish oil, I was taking all this stuff, and I was taking a lot of supplements every day, and resveratrol and enzymes, and then maybe not quite 2 years later, I find a lump in my left breast, just about the exact same spot as I found the other lump. So, you know, you don't know much, and there's not a lot of information, but one thing that it said was, if you get anything before 2 years, that's a bad sign. So I was thinking, oh, this is charming. Here I go again. So I decided to go to a different surgeon because I was not happy with the original guy because he did the lymph node removal without discussion. And I now go to a surgeon who's a female who would have been my first choice if I knew that I could choose my own doctor.
Can you give her name? Are we allowed to give her name?
Deborah Axelrod.
Okay.
She's in New York City, and she was, you know, sympathetic and willing to work with me. However, she said in the beginning, she said, oh, well, this feels very granular, and chances are it's not cancer, and you should just wait till your regular scheduled mammogram. Now, the thing about that is, and this is also part of my philosophy, it's not personal to say to somebody, wait for your scheduled mammogram. In my case, it was worse than that because I had invasive lobular, not the usual ductal carcinoma. And carcinoma is another word for cancer. So the issue for me was, if my original tumors didn't exactly show up on a mammogram, why would I think the new ones would? But, you know, I didn't think about it really clearly. And retrospectively, I know everything, haha. But, you know, back then I didn't really know. So I waited. And then when I had the mammogram, the tech says to me, well, you know, if I were you, I'd have a biopsy. So wise guy that I am, I said, well, I heard half the techs always say biopsy and the other half don't. And she said, look, you had cancer, get a biopsy. So I got a biopsy, and underneath the tumor that I felt, which was only 0.6 millimeters, so it was small, was a complete 1.5 centimeter tumor, 1.5 centimeters, that was also consistent with my prior diagnosis. And so here I was with more cancer, and I had a second lumpectomy, although they wanted to do a salvage mastectomy. And again, this comes down to my personal medicine view. Salvage mastectomy, oh, that's what we do whenever someone has a recurrence. So I said, wait, what is Ann Fonfa going to do? Because that's not, I don't do what everyone does. Now, in this case, I was wrong. I should have had a mastectomy. And the reason I should have is because it continued to recur. And it recurred. I had another lumpectomy, and then finally I had a mastectomy. So now I have one breast, and I'm thinking, well, I'm a warrior woman, you know, this is cool. And, you know, I was doing okay. And then less than a year later, the second breast had what looked like a rash, and that turned out to be Paget's disease of the nipple. Subsequently, I had a mastectomy on the right side, so now I have no breasts. But I discovered after the fact a study that indicated that if you have a lower diagnosis of cancer in the future, it might mean that your body is healing itself. So had I known that, I might not have had the second mastectomy. But it also did not have a tumor. I asked the doctor to really, you know, slice it and dice it and tell me what was going on. So in addition to maybe not needing it at all, it didn't even have a tumor. So that side did not have cancer, which was the good news, bad news kind of thing. And you can't glue it back on because I asked you to. So, you know, I was not feeling really cool about the whole thing, but now I had no breasts. Now the left side gets chest wall tumors, little tiny, tiny, tiny tumors. And now they tell me, oh, you're stage 4. And I said, well, what do you mean? And they say, well, it's probably a metastatic occurrence on the chest wall. And I say, well, I don't understand. And they say, well, it's probable that the tumors went through your body, and now they came back, and they're on your chest wall. So, I don't know, probably didn't sound very good to me, and I didn't see how they could tell someone they're stage 4 in a probably kind of way. So I just completely disregarded that. I thought, I don't think they're speaking to me. I don't believe I'm stage 4. And I proceeded to have tumors and tumors and tumors, and I was doing a lot of things. So several things worked, fascinatingly, to reduce the tumors. One of them was high-dose vitamin A. Oh, in the interim, I forgot to say, I did a lot of things.
Now, who recommended the high-dose vitamin A? Because vitamin A can definitely be toxic in high doses as well.
Right. So it's an interesting thing because, first of all, everyone's different. So I forgot to mention that I went to the Gerson Clinic in Mexico.
Let's
and I did
talk
the
about the Gerson
program.
Clinic in depth, because that is one that has been around a very long time. And several people who have had very good experiences there. I'm not sure what your experiences was like, but what was it like going to the Gerson Clinic?
So I went with my mother as a companion, so I was very comfortable there. Also, I was probably the healthiest person there because I didn't have, you know, I wasn't recovering from chemo. I didn't have any kind of organ problems or anything like that. Everybody there was pretty sick. You know, they were all, in fact, in those days, the majority of people who went to Mexico were people who, for whom conventional treatment just didn't work. And so they were a mess by the time they got there.
So
you know,
many
they'd
people
been
who go there, they wait till it's really end stage when probably out of body counseling and how to die correctly might have been a better choice. But it's like a last minute grabbing at straws.
Yeah, it was a last resort for a lot of people. But I saw amazing things happen. So I did see people who came in wheelchairs be able to walk out. I did see that. And I was nervous, you know, I was still dealing with candida back at the time that I went. So I was nervous when they said, oh, it's, and I knew the protocol, but it didn't quite ring until I got there. And it's 13 juices a day, and a lot of them are carrots. And I had been told, A, that carrots were estrogenic, and I probably should avoid them, which is incorrect. And B, that, you know, it was a lot of sugar when you juice carrots.
Which is true.
So I said to the doctor, you know, I don't think I can do this. And he said, well, we're a hospital, so why don't you try it, see how you feel. And then if things aren't working, you know, you can always try something else. So that made a lot of sense. So I decided to do that, and I started drinking. And I want to say within a few days, the candida difficulty began to recede. I felt less pain in, you know, and less rashes.
What else did they do besides the juices?
Well, their program is shots of liver I forget the actual aspect of what the liver is, but I wrote a diary while I was there so that I would remember everything, and I wrote it down day by day, so it's all what happened as it happened. So they do something with liver. They did heat treatments. They did some I did IV vitamin C drip at night, which was very interesting. And overall, you know, a lot of different things, but it was not high-tech. It was pretty low-tech. And they also wanted to do a bone scan because they you know, I'd never had a bone scan, strangely. And even though I was now supposedly stage four, I don't know, it was really odd. So I had a bone scan. It didn't show anything, which was fine with me. And I basically left there feeling okay, but since I felt so strong, I didn't stay for the entire three-week course. I felt like it wasn't necessary for me to do that, and I was anxious to get back to my life. So that's what I did. And when I got back, the program is...
Is the Gerson Clinic still in existence?
There are Gerson clinics. The Gerson Research Institute, Gerson Institute runs a clinic. I think it's in Mexico. And they all have offices in the U.S., and, you know, you can reach Gerson.org to get information on that. And but I had not gone to the Gerson Institute's clinic. I went to one run by Gar Hildebrand for the Gerson Research Organization, which I do not believe has a clinic at this time at all anymore. But, so I get back, and it's 18 months to do the program. I ended up quitting my job because you really cannot do the program while you're working. It's impossible. There's so much to do. You have to make 13 juices a day, and you have to do 4 coffee enemas a day, which I learned how to do. I'd actually started doing them prior to my going because it sounded like a good idea to detox. And also because I was somebody who was constipated most of my adult life, and I spent a lot of time with doctors telling me, oh, you know, it's perfectly normal. Oh, twice a week? Oh, no, that's fine, dear. That's you. And, you know, I knew it wasn't right, but I couldn't get any help for it. So by the time I found out about coffee enemas, I knew that was something I really wanted to add to my protocol, and I did. And so I'm doing the Gerson protocol. It's, like I said, it's 18 months. And I was home, you know, most of the time because...
I just want to tell our listeners that if you do visit AnnieAppleseedProject.org, where our guest, Ann Fonfa, has really done a very in-depth job of providing tons of free information. And if you want to find something specific that we're talking about, you go to AnnieAppleseedProject.org, and she has a search engine, and I just typed in Gerson, and all kinds of articles and information comes up about in-depth information about the Gerson therapies and the Gerson clinics. So that's
thank
a
you very
wonderful
much.
Thing.
I appreciate that. And like I said, I did keep a diary during the time I was there, so it's absolutely contemporary information that I discovered as I went along. And so I found the program to be complicated to do. I had to have a schedule on the wall in order to keep up with everything. But, I continued to get healthier and healthier, and I felt well throughout this whole experience. You know, remember, I didn't have chemo, so my immune system wasn't dragged down. My health, my energy, none of that was destroyed. And that was better because I really had more room to maneuver, I felt, during that time period than most of the people that I had met with cancer. And I had joined a support group, and there were a lot of suffering women and a few men, you know, who really were just, you know, they had no energy and they had no joie de vie anymore.
But they had already had chemo, and that's what
yeah, they had conventional treatment.
It seems
yeah, it was
to take
exhausting.
People out almost faster than just allowing the cancer to run its course in many cases, unfortunately.
One of the things that struck me at the time, I started a group called Whole Health Study Group with a friend, and she immediately went to graduate school, so I was running it on my own. But one of the things that I saw was that the stuff that worked for me, and I do want to get back to the chest wall information on that, could work for people while they were in treatment and certainly afterwards. And I feel, and I felt and still feel that it's very, very important to do healthy behaviors during treatment. A lot of physicians are taught to say to their patients, oh, you know, don't do anything. And I say to people, look, ask what the evidence is for not doing stuff, because you really have to maintain your health. It's a lot more difficult to take a supplement, let's say, to control a problem that you got from chemotherapy after the fact than it is contemporarily
but
with
people
treatment.
Are absolutely told not to eat vegetables, not to take vitamins.
Crazy. Yeah, crazy
well,
stuff.
You know what? Sometimes it's correct. The thing is, there are some really wonderful doctors around. For instance, Lise Alschuler. I don't know if you're familiar with her.
Sure, and she's spoken at one of our conferences.
She is fantastic, and she does an in-depth analysis, like you said, of the individual, because that advice should vary depending on the situation with the individual as well as the kind of chemo that you're using. Because what she points out, and all her discussions are evidence-based, is with some chemotherapy agents, how they work, for instance, is to stop the tumor from being able to absorb B vitamins, and that's how it works on destroying the tumor. And if you are taking foods high in B vitamins and especially supplementing with B vitamins, you're actually moving everything in the other direction. But there are other chemotherapy agents and other situations where using specific nutrients will actually make the chemo more effective so that the dose can be lowered so that you can have a better outcome and a lower adverse effect ratio. So this should be dealt with, like you keep saying, on an individual basis, not just telling all patients, don't take any vegetables and don't take any supplements. That is the wrong information. But just saying go ahead and do it without looking into the connection is also not the best choice.
You know, if doctor visits were covered by, if those complementary therapy, integrative doctors, alternative doctors were covered by insurance for their visits, that would make it a lot easier for people. It's one of the things we're working on with Annie Appleseed Project and our advocacy, because that is what limits people from really being able to get the help they need and the personalized as much as possible.
You are so right. Now, we're just going to take one more little break here, because we like Progressive Radio Network to be able to tell people about all the fantastic shows that they have here. And while we take a break, take a look at AnnieAppleseedProject.org so that you'll know where to find it when someone you know, and unfortunately we all have people that we know, are trying to investigate some of the complementary and alternative therapies that are available should you get this diagnosis. And we will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Thank you so much for joining us today right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we're happy that you're with us. We'd love to hear from you. You can get in touch with us at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse, and let us know that you're listening. Let us know what you'd like to hear about in terms of topics here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And, of course, you can listen to many of the shows presented by Progressive Radio Network by going to the archives at prn.fm. You could look at each show, go down to Natural Nurse, and when I looked at the stats recently, I was really happy to see that we have had over 100,000 downloads of our shows, The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And you can join us on ground. Check out naturalnurse.com schedule and see the many classes and workshops that we give in person, as well as our herbal certification course that is available to anyone online right in their home. And today we have as our guest Anne Fonfa, and she is a truth advocate, I would say, and her website is AnnieAppleseedProject.org, and you can visit there, start your search, or if someone that you know or love, know and love, would like to seek out, what else can they do? And you know, Anne, one thing I love about your presentation is it's very inclusive. You're not telling people to walk your path. You're telling people to make up their own mind. Don't be pushed into therapies just because they're standards of practice.
Yeah, thank you. Congratulations on the downloads. That's great. Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, what I discovered about about the things I did, they could work for anybody in combination with whatever treatments they choose. And that's really important. There are a lot of things that do work together, and it's important to know that. But it's also it's important to just know there are possibilities. And that was very important to me during my search for answers, just to know. So I had mentioned before that I was taking high-dose vitamin A, and that you asked me, you know, how that began. So I did a lot of going to various doctors all around the New York City area, and I went to Canada. I was trying to gather information that would be helpful. Other women came with me who were seekers for information. And I found a doctor who some research that I did led me to Dr. Maurice Black, who'd done some research with vitamin A, and his associate, whose name I can no longer recall, is a very complicated name, sorry to say, and I'm bad with names. But what he was doing a controlled study of people with vitamin A, and he was giving it to people in a controlled way and looking at, you know, what how they were doing and so on. But what he wanted me to do, as I found very often, was to do only what he was doing and nothing else. And in a controlled trial, I understand now that that's required. But I didn't want to give up what had kept me going, even though I supposedly had stage 4 disease at that time. And I was just afraid to not do the protocol that I was doing. So I didn't do his protocol, but I had this feeling in my mind, you know, vitamin A. And then I also was at a meeting where I saw the Maitake Mushroom, now called Mushroom Wisdom Company, and they had a display about their Maitake diffraction. And I decided when I had a chest wall tumor that I would take the Maitake diffraction, and I did. And it reduced the tumor that I had growing on the chest wall. However, a new tumor grew. So that wasn't the complete answer yet. And then I decided to try dosing of high-dose vitamin A. And when I say high-dose, I started out, I took a product from the shelf, and it was vitamin A palmitate in tablet form, and I began to take 300,000 IUs a day for the first week. And I was following the protocol that was outlined by the doctor I had visited, as well as one of the clinicians at the clinic in Mexico. And he and I were in constant contact about what I was doing, and I was speaking to him weekly to try to determine if I was on the right track for me. So I did the high-level dose, and when I spoke to the doctor in Mexico the following week, he said, oh, you're supposed to take a different version of the vitamin A. But what I had to report, I'm sorry, not the following, 3 weeks later, and the reason I called him was that 3 weeks, almost to the day, I saw a tumor reduction. So I was ecstatic, to say the least, because, you know, here I was with years of recurrence and nothing happening, and finally I had action. And
now,
said,
let's talk about your work at in terms of spreading this information, because we're coming up to the end of the show, and I think that's important component to what you do. In terms of your conferences, which gather together various health professionals, I presented there myself 1 year, and you have excellent presenters that give information in a way people can understand it. I know you hold them in Florida. You've also held one in the New York area. And are those conferences now available in terms of some of the content online in case people cannot make it to the conference itself?
We don't ourselves sell it, but the companies that do the taping do sell DVDs or CDs. We are working on some of the older versions. We hope to have them out online, or some are on YouTube, I should say, at this point. And we're trying to make more of them available if we can. The conference is held every year. We do charge a fee to go. It's $249 to come. That includes 2 organic buffet lunches, an organic
reception.
Which
are delicious. I will vouch for that.
Yes. And lately, local farmers have been donating produce, so we've been juicing at every conference, and that's really fun. We have beautiful fresh-made juices at the break time. Also, the speakers are chosen so that they cover the 3 different areas that we consider important, and that is reducing risk, which is basically a lot of the same stuff but in different dosages and protocols, and then working with conventional treatment to reduce toxicities and for people to regain their health. As we start talking about survivorship, we need people to know what to do to get their energy back and so on. And then for people for whom treatment is not working or, like me, who for one reason or another decide to go alternative. And so we have those kinds of speakers talking about all of those different things. great networking. You meet people who are like-minded, and they spend a lot of time. All the speakers are eat lunch together with everybody. We have continuing education credits for any health professionals who'd like to come. So we have about a third of the people are people with cancer, a third are practitioners, and a third are family or advocates. And the reason we want advocates is because we really want the message to get out. I have devoted myself as a to working in the organization that I founded, Annie Appleseed Project, to try to get information to people when they need it. I mean, my dream is that everybody with cancer knows the minute they get a diagnosis to go to our site, because we have information on how to make surgery easier. And let me just tell your listeners one thing, because this makes me crazy. So there's a study, there's a group called Cochrane, which is an international collaboration, and when they do a meta-analysis, which is a gathering of studies to find the truth, evidence-based, and they have found that children who are our most delicate people can drink water up to 2 hours before surgery without a problem. So right now, the protocol has always been your doctor says, oh, nothing after midnight. But really, that's not about you. Once again, people become dehydrated, children especially. So you can have clear liquids, and you can look it up at Cochrane.org. That's their library online, and see that it's possible to drink water. So that's just one of the crazy things that you need to know when you're going into surgery. If you get dehydrated, your veins shrink, it's harder to, you know, to recover, and drinking water, that's all you need to up to 2 hours. But if you feel nervous about it, do it 4 hours ahead. Arnica, a way to reduce swelling, bleeding, and bruising, can go under your tongue the day before surgery, the morning of, again, without harm. So anyway, so those are the kinds of things we cover on our site and at our meeting. And it's just a great, you know, we also have free yoga, we have qigong, we have exercise information, we have a journal that we produce which has 4 or 5 articles in it on topics of interest. We
have product giveaways. How many years has the conference been going on?
This will be our 9th conference, but it's our 8th year because we did do one in San Francisco in 2012 as well as West Palm Beach. But, you know, we're a poor organization, all volunteers. We don't really fundraise. So whatever we can manage, we always manage the West Palm Beach conference. We were able to host, as you referred to, the Long Island conference in 2009. But generally, we just do one big meeting a year in West Palm. And we accept donations, by the way, if anybody's so moved. We use most of the money for scholarships for the conference. We send advocates to meetings so that we can gather information directly and also be able to share our information. We have health message postcards, and on our site we have a couple of really important handouts. One is a handout on evidence-based information to reduce toxicity. Anybody can download it. If you do print it out, make it double-sided just to save paper.
So what would they search on your site at Annie
Appleseed? It's in the section called Information by Product. Information by Cancer Types. And if you just scroll down, you can see it says handout in a bold, underlined way. And that will take you. Yeah, so that will take you a PDF handout of, and we also have one, if you scroll down under children, the category, it has a handout on pediatric with citations, so you can show it to your doctor and discuss, you know, but be prepared that your doc may not know as much as she or he should about these issues, but you can show them the evidence base, and you can make a decision based on, you know, the safety protocol and the evidence that we have gathered for you. That's what we do. Then we go to conferences. I just got back yesterday from a conference in Orlando on breast cancer and breast health, international meeting, and I had a poster where I showed our health message postcard, and people like it. It's a very simple message that even a doctor who's been trained to say no can't say no to. And we say in the most basic way, here's your 3 steps for health. First one is eat one more fruit and one more vegetable a day. Take a walk. And take 7 deep breaths before treatment, before bedtime, before any time of anxiety. Just the basic thing. And people feel better from that alone, and then they're willing to take the next steps to be healthy. We want to reach everybody. We want to help everybody. Now, next February 26th to 28th in West Palm Beach, its registration is open on our website. It's all over the place on our website. And we welcome everybody to join us. And again, there will be DVDs and CDs if people want them. You can look on our YouTube. We have an Annie Appleseed Project channel, lots of videos there. We also have a very active Facebook where I post information just about every day. We're also on Twitter, again, with information almost every day. And our money, again, you know, we have our expenses are covered by my family's donations. So we have very low expenses. And most of our money is to send advocates or me or board members to meetings so that we can share information and gather it directly. We want people to know, everybody should know, that it's possible to be healthier during treatment, to survive and be well.
Well, thank you so much, Anne, and thank you for listening, all you listeners, and for downloading. And, of course, you can find out more at annieappleseedproject.org, and you can reach us all the time at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. Until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.